Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground.
Hello, and welcome to the Garden Goddess Show on WDRT Radio 91.9 FM from Viroqua, Wisconsin. I'm Donna Smith, and I'm so happy to be back this month to talk gardening with you for the next half hour. On today's show, my guest is Mikkel, and we'll discuss paradise gardening, what it is, why it's important, and how you can create a beautiful, sustainable garden paradise of your very own. We'll also cover a garden tool I was introduced to, and I'll tell you about a couple of gardening books worth checking out. We'll get started with a couple of questions from the garden cart. If you have a question about something going on in your garden or want some help or advice, you can email me. Send an email to gardening@wdrt.org, and I'll try to answer those questions on a future show. Nicole asked me what may have happened to tomato seeds that she was starting, but they never germinated. I'm sorry to hear about that. Old seed could be one possibility. The soil to start your seeds can have an impact on germination. When starting seeds, a soilless seed starting mix is a good medium to plant in. The fine texture offers better drainage, aeration, and moisture retention, and it allows the delicate roots to emerge and establish. You want to be sure that the seeds are not buried too deep and the soil stays moist, but not soaking wet, which can also cause the seeds or the seedlings to rot. A bit of heat can help speed up germination as well. Once they have at least two true leaves, transplant into potting soil where the seedlings will get more nutrients that they need for better growth. You'll want to get them into more light as well to keep them growing and not stretching and becoming leggy. Hope that helps, Nicole, for future seed starting. I also got a question about the slow growth of peppers. When transplanting outside, make sure the soil temp is at least 60 degrees. This is usually about 2 to 3 weeks after the last frost in our area. If not, this can slow their growth and root development and delay flowering. The University of Maryland Extension suggests removing the first blooms on your peppers to encourage stronger growth and better fruit production later. When we get the temperature extremes that we've experienced lately, like high temps over 90 degrees, followed by cooler days and nights, this can also affect your pepper plants. We're having a very wet growing season so far. If you have poor drainage in your garden, these plants may have too much water, which may be contributing to their slow growth. Or if your flower blossoms are dropping, this could be an indicator of stress. High humidity, improper watering, nutrient deficiency, or pollinator problems can all stress out your plants. It's hard to do anything about the humidity and temperature extremes, but you can monitor the moisture in your soil and fertilize as needed. A tip about pollination in the garden comes from Stephanie. When I visited Stephanie's garden during the recent garden walk, she mentioned that last season she had lots of flowers on plants like her pumpkins and squash, but not much fruit. She realized she didn't have the pollinators in her garden. This year, she has increased the number of flowering plants to encourage pollinators. The result has been great, and she has seen an increase in fruit production this season. Now it's time for our patio talk with my guest, Mikkel And of Dreamtime Village. You may be familiar with Mikkel from the farmer's market in Viroqua, where he sells a very nice variety of plants. And he was also recently at the Colorwork Nursery during the garden walk, representing Driftless Sacred Grove with a variety of vinegars and meads. Thanks for coming in today, Mikkel.
Hi-ho!
It's great to have you here. When we talked at the farmer's market a couple weeks ago, you mentioned to me the concept of paradise gardening. I wasn't familiar with the term. Can you explain that, where it comes from, and how you got started in that?
The term actually has been used by a bunch of different people, but the person who popularized it the most is someone named Joe Hollis, who had an apothecary in the Black Mountain in Asheville, North Carolina, and was an amazing, amazing sort of resource for his particular focus was Chinese herbs and stuff. And so he was mm-hmm. growing all the temperate hardy Chinese herbs at his place, and he was on this on the mountainside of Black Mountain, and he had this tiny, tiny little spot, maybe 2-3 acres, and he probably had 200 or 300 different things growing there.
Wow.
And Joe, in the early 90s, was popularizing this idea called paradise gardening, which is the idea of having, you know, paradise now, of creating just sort of unlimited concept of biodiversity in your backyard. And this is right at the point where sort of permaculture stuff is beginning to happen and beginning to be thought about in the United States. So
okay.
he really was at the foreground when thinking about the paradise gardening idea. And then when Dreamtime Village was formed, we had a newsletter called Dreamtime Talking Mail for the first 4 or 5 years. We made like 2,000 copies of the issues and gave them away free. And so one of the issues did a long, long feature on paradise gardening and Joe Hollis and explained the whole concept and how we were integrating it into Dreamtime Village and our practices there.
So it's very much related to permaculture.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason it's called paradise gardening is to get in sort of a metaphorical sense to think about gardening. So it's not... So you don't approach it thinking, well, you know, I'm trained in horticulture and this is how I'm going to do things. You're
right.
You're anyone, and you have an interest in seeing biodiversity, and you want to participate in your own personal kind of paradise. And so it's a kind of a way of being more participatory, more inclusive, being more welcoming. A lot of permaculture stuff is pretty information heavy, and usually people who are doing permaculture have gone through quite a bit of training to really like, or education to get to the point they are. And I think paradise gardening is much more, almost more of a poetic version of it.
Sure. And one of the things I read is that it's more of an ecological concept that encourages us to be use a more regenerative approach to agriculture and gardening.
Yeah, of course. And make use of what you have. And I think one of the things of paradise gardening is that is about having specific connections with specific plants, or what some people call plant allies. And so each person is going to have different connections to different plants, and these connections will develop. You know, I've had some connections with plants I've had for 35 years, you know, mm-hmm. and over 35 years, these plants are talking to you, and you're listening to them, and you're gaining information, and you have a kind of a feedback and exchange going on. It's okay. really very much a part of that.
Okay. Could this also be something like if you are in need of medicinal plants, for instance, then those might be the things that you grow in your garden?
Right. Or if you have a real, nutritionally, there's something that is missing from your diet, and your body is telling you you need this, this, and this, and you start growing those things rather than buying them at the grocery store or ordering them from Amazon. So you're taking like a direct action in your own life, but you're also, once again, you're inviting these kinds of plant energies into your life.
So you're living a little bit more in harmony with the nature that's around you.
Yeah, I put harmony in quotes, but yeah.
Okay. you would hope you are.
Yeah.
And so how do the people with those gardens and the wildlife that comes into the garden, how do they benefit from this style of gardening?
Well, one of the things I think that one of the reasons why I've really adopted the whole idea of paradise gardening is that here in the United States, a lot of the concepts of gardening come from England in the 17th century, which is a super, super, super manicured, overly taken care of, everything exact and perfect and in its place approach to gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something. But in paradise gardening, there are no weeds. Every plant is its own entity, and it has its own sort of purpose for being there. There are invasive plants that need to be taken care of, but they're not weeds. They need to be used and worked with, and cycle into the future and stuff. You know, for instance, at my vineyard in the last 3 or 4 years, I have been invaded by ragweed from the farms next to me, and ragweed gets to be about 14 to 16 feet high, 1.5 inch diameter stalks. When it is fully, you know, end of August, it is as close together as you see a corn planting. You can't even push through it. And on top of it, I'm severely allergic to ragweed, like anaphylactic shock, severe worth of ragweed. So it's definitely one of the messengers in my life, and it speaks to me a lot, and I refuse to call it a weed. The other interesting thing of ragweed is that its Latin is ambrosia, so that's a real irony of sort of this plant that everybody just, like, you know, let's put pesticides on it and get rid of it. Sure. And in paradise gardening, every plant is a teacher whether you like it or not.
Sure. Okay. So as a beginner, beginning gardener, what challenges do you think someone would face when they're trying to convert their yard into this more paradise of a garden?
If you live in a city, most likely the city ordinances are the biggest challenge. But if you're living somewhere where there isn't a huge amount of regulations about what you plant, then I think the biggest challenge for beginners is not, like a lot of folks learn from, say, they'll open up a magazine and they'll see beautiful gardens and they'll think, well, that's what I want. And in a way, that is really removed from sitting in your yard and just observing and watching things and letting your yard sort of over seasons, letting your yard inform you what wants to be there. So you're co-creating with the yard rather than superimposing some design that somebody had 25 years ago in your yard and then trying to make that happen. And then you start worrying when things don't work. For instance, at the farmer's market, I constantly get people who want to have Honeycrisp apples in their yard because everybody sees these big, beautiful Honeycrisp apples, and they want their apples to look like that. Well, the only way in Wisconsin you're going to have a Honeycrisp apple that looks like that is if you spray it once a week.
Right.
And most beginning gardeners are not going to want to spray anything. They just don't want to have to deal with that stuff. So there's a big difference between sort of these visions these people have of sort of what a paradise is and what is more realistic based on what their wants and needs and education and desires and so forth are.
Would you say that when you're trying to create a paradise garden, are you looking mostly at native plants? Because you've kind of mentioned, you know, if you kind of watch and see what's coming up in your garden, you'll see what wants to grow there. But oftentimes in our gardens with such disturbed soil, we are getting an abundance of weeds and we're not getting kind of the native plants that might actually want to be in some of these environments.
Oh, in a way, that's a discussion in itself. But one of the things to keep in mind is that if you're interested in growing fruits, nuts, and berries, almost none of them are native. You know, service berries are native, nanny berries are native, but, you know, apples, pears, peaches, apricots, prunus, pawpaws, all these things come, well, pawpaws are actually close to being native, but most of the other traditional fruits come from, you know, Southeastern Asia, Kazakhstan area. So the concept of native is useful sometimes, but also it could be a hindrance too in terms of what you're doing. If you approach it from the point of what am I going to do to create pollinizers for all the insects and butterflies and stuff that are disappearing from the planet, then that becomes a different sort of discussion because there's things that work really well and there's things that don't work well. But once again, I'll say that some of my best pollinators at my vineyard is Canadian thistle, which of course is considered an intense invasive in Wisconsin, and pretty much every non-organic farmer is spraying for it constantly. So once again, you're working with these plants and you have to position yourself someplace that you're comfortable with in relationship to all the different theories about, you know, I deal with a lot of people who are just only native plant people, and so it's not that I disrespect them or anything, but I dance to a different drummer.
Okay. But when I saw you recently at the Garden Walk, you were talking about Aronia, for instance.
Right, right. There's a good there's a native that fits almost all profiles, exactly.
And are there other native fruits that you would suggest to somebody if they wanted to try to add those?
So we're 200 miles north of the native range of the pawpaw, but because of whatever is happening on the planet, pawpaws are doing fine in this area. And there's a huge, huge history of pawpaws being used by Native American tribes all over the United States going back hundreds of years. In fact, I have a map of all of 60 different indigenous names for the pawpaw fruit, and it's a map of the United States, and it shows all the different tribal names and stuff for it, just as a way of showing how that particular fruit has existed there for, you know, probably for hundreds of years. And then going back to the pawpaw was one of the main foods of the mastodons.
Okay. What other fruits might we grow in our gardens that would be beneficial?
Well, once again, it depends on what your site is. In an urban setting, you're always dealing with space and stuff. So, not only is it choosing kind of which fruit plants you want, but also choosing what kind of rootstock you want some of these plants on. Because, you know, a full size apple tree or a full size pear tree can be 40 feet high, 25 feet wide. That might fill up your whole front yard, just that one tree.
Sure.
But you put one of those on a dwarf rootstock, first of all, it bears way, way quicker, like in a couple of years rather than 6 or 7 years. But also, its profile is way, way smaller. So it's not just choosing the fruits, but also choosing rootstocks for the kinds of trees that have rootstocks. One other really important thing that I try to really emphasize a lot is, and once again, this is, you have to kind of learn this stuff by word of mouth and just by experience. I learned because I basically killed everything that didn't work. But that's an expensive way to learn. There's actually easier ways to learn than planting everything and watching it die because of some disease. Is that most of the fruits have far more disease-resistant varieties than other kinds of varieties. So, for instance, with apples, I mentioned Honeycrisp, which is a disease magnet. Well, something like Liberty or Enterprise are really good no-spray apples. Lots and lots of people have those in their yards. They've never, ever sprayed them. Not necessarily every apple on the tree is going to be, you know, market ready. But, on a regular year, most of that fruit will be pretty good and pretty usable and stuff.
Sure.
The same is true for most of the other kinds of tree fruits. I know less about bramble, so I can't really speak to that. And the same would be true with something like currants. There's current varieties that are much more resistant to downy mildew, which kind of looks like somebody spilled milk on your plant. That's one of the main issues with currants in the area. So, planting disease-resistant varieties means you don't have to spray those. I'm no spray organic, but I really I don't even spray organic sprays. I find a lot of the organic sprays are toxic in other kinds of ways. They're not necessarily chemically toxic, but there's other kinds of things that, you know, for instance, my skin gets really rashes and stuff when I use pyrethium-based organic sprays and stuff.
Okay.
One of the beauties of this area is that there are so many people who are already doing this stuff, and there's a huge, diverse kind of network of information that's already out there. And one of the best things is just to really like ask lots of people questions. You know, if you can afford to have consultations from somebody who knows their stuff, getting consultations and stuff before you begin things. But the main thing that I recommend is observing. Before you start planting and doing stuff, sitting in your yard, seeing what it looks like in the spring when it starts to melt, seeing what it looks like in the winter with the snow cover, seeing what it looks like when it's been raining for a week, and just looking at the ground, looking at the trees, looking at the drainage, looking at the airflow, all these different things sort of are interactive with the things that you're planting.
I think that is a great message to end on. I think, you know, many people have these beautiful gardens and they never go out in them and make observations about things. When I worked at, volunteered at a plant clinic and answered people's questions, we'd often had someone call and say, I just went out in my yard and then my tree's all defoliated. Well, that doesn't typically happen right overnight during the middle of the growing season. So that was something that was probably going on for quite a while. So going out and observing what's going on in your yard will certainly help for you to know what's working, what's not working.
I have one last thing to finish with. And usually when I'm doing consultations, the first thing I ask, or people will tell me, I want to do this, this, and this, and this. And the first thing I ask is, how are you going to use them? You know, so why plant apples unless you're going to pick the apples? Or why plant currants unless you're going to pick the currants? And all these things require human energy to do to begin with. So, you know, if you're not going to put the energy into actually harvesting it and putting it up and making use of it, maybe you're best off to kind of go in a different direction than to, you know, grow these things and just watch it fall on the ground. Unless, of course, you're just planting things for wildlife or something like that.
Right. So maybe planting for the wildlife is a better option
than planting something
that you're not going to utilize.
In which case, you would plant different plants.
Sure.
Or different fruits and nuts.
Okay. Well, you've given us a lot of things to think about today. So hopefully my listeners will get out and create a space with some useful plants in their garden or edibles, things for wildlife, and they'll be encouraged to get out and do some of that. Thank you so much, Mikkel, for coming in and joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Welcome to the Driftless.
Now on to the bookshelf. This month, I've revisited an old favorite called Midwest Gardens by Pamela Wolfe with the photography of Gary Irving. The book highlights 22 gardens around the Midwest. It's packed with beautiful photos and lots of information on the garden plants and the designs. You'll be inspired by the stories behind each garden's creation, as well as the wide variety of garden designs they represent. This book came to mind after I attended the Friends of the Kickapoo Valley Reserve Garden Walk on Sunday, July 13th. The garden walk snuck up on me and I almost missed it. I was able to tour several gardens that I had not visited before. There is a lot of diversity in the gardens on the walk. The gardeners range from those with many years of experience and others relatively new to gardening. They are all enthusiastic about their landscapes, and it was really enjoyable to see the variety of gardens. I hope you'll put the mid-July walk on your calendar for next summer if you missed it, and plan to see some of the great gardens right here in Vernon County. The second book is another one by an author that I highlighted a couple months ago, Douglas Talamay, called Bringing Nature Home. This one goes along with today's paradise gardening theme in a way. Talamay provides compelling information for the use of native plants in our landscape and how important that is for the birds and the insects that inhabit them. If you're looking for a guide to increase the biodiversity in your garden, this book can be that guide. I know I'll be referencing the information as I work on my own property. In the tool shed today is a new item that I was introduced to. I haven't bought one yet, but I'm looking. This is a shovel called the Root Slayer Shovel. You can find one by the brand Radius Garden that's kind of an ergonomic shape with a round handle. Theirs is carbon steel shovel and the handle is poly. You can also find ones with wooden handles. The shovels are about 44 inches long, about the length of the average garden spade. They have a semi-V-shaped blade, good for digging perennials and digging out large weeds like wild parsnip. I was at an event in the spring, and I think it was the prairie enthusiasts who sell a similar tool for digging out invasive plants like the wild parsnip. If you're using it for that, be very careful digging the wild parsnip, as the oils of the plant are phototoxic and will cause a burn if you're exposed to their oils and sunlight. Wear long sleeves, long pants and gloves, hat and safety glasses, and best to do this later in the day, like early evening time, and or on a very cloudy day. You can find this tool at many stores that sell garden tools. The Garden Journal this month has a few tasks for you to keep in mind in the days ahead. Right now, it's weeding, weeding, weeding. All the rain has made everything in the garden just go crazy. Some of the weeds are getting so big, so get out there before it's too overwhelming. Mowing lawns can be a challenge with all this rain, too. Some weeks, it's been hard to find a dry day to mow. When mowing, let your grass clippings lay on the lawn instead of bagging them. And please blow your grass back onto the lawn instead of into the road. Those grass clippings will do your lawn much more good as they break down and add nutrients to your soil. In the road, they become slippery and hazardous, especially at this time of the year for the walkers and the bikers. Some of your annuals and perennials may need some attention. Prune off spent flowers and trim stems back to keep them from flopping over. Your annuals may also need a boost of fertilizer to keep them blooming. If you have diseased plants in the veggie garden, be sure to be cleaning that up and disposing of the foliage to keep things from spreading in the garden. And now is a good time to start seeds for fall garden crops. If you plan to put in fall garden bulbs, be sure to be ordering those soon so you'll get the ones you want and you'll have them just in time for planting. Thanks so much for joining me today. I've enjoyed spending this time with you and my guest, Mikkel Ande. Please join me again next month for another discussion about gardening and plants. I'll leave you with my garden quote for today. It comes from author and gardener Christopher Lloyd from his book, The Well-Tempered Garden, from 1973. Not all seedlings are weeds. You may feel that life is too short to leave a seedling in till it's large enough to identify. My own feeling is that life's too interesting not to leave it there until you can identify it. Have a wonderful day, friends. Let's go out and make our world a little more beautiful, one plant at a time.